All right, tonight's the 35th week. It's called Woman Power. All right, so we're going to start off with a video. The title of the video is Be a Leader, How to Be a Powerful Woman. And for the men on the call, all right, you'll learn a little bit. All right, let's check it out. I got some questions for you guys. Can you see the sheet? Good. All right. According to this video of these interviews of these executives who are in England, what is the mark of a powerful woman, powerful modern woman? Or at least what they claim. Did anybody get that from the video? I'm going to pick on the women first because you're more likely to have listened to it. Shayna.
One of the qualities I heard was to keep your integrity. That I think the woman said, without your integrity, you don't have anything pretty much.
That's true. Now, that's not necessarily a woman thing. That really is true for men and women. Obviously, if people think you're a lying bastard, you're not the people are going to want to work with you or trust you. So that, I mean, that's true. It wasn't really a feminine. That was a, that's true. What was the mark of what were they trying to convey as a mark of a powerful modern woman? What else did they say? John, what else did they say?
They're vocal.
They're vocal. So a modern. So you're saying the mark of a powerful modern woman is, in contrast to being quiet, they're now vocal. That was
right. The more assertive.
Assertive. Okay, this came through. What else? I'm gonna blend into the second question. What style of leadership differ? I'm gonna add the word from men. You know, according to what they were saying, that came through with a couple of the people. How did the one woman who was a philanthropist, how did she say the male manner of leadership? Anybody hop it? Suzanne?
I'm guessing, but probably male leadership, they're more forceful, right? Like they do it through force, where females are a little bit more passive aggressive.
It's true. How did she articulate that? I don't know if you caught the more of a, that's true in general.
Anybody it's hard for me to hear.
Okay, hard for you to hear. All right. Suzanne?
It was hard to hear, but one thing I heard one of the women say was to have people say nice things about you just to be respected. And I know that's also applicable to men as well. And then I heard one of the other women say something about she may have to repeat herself, but it was kind of hard to hear.
Okay, sorry about that. But the main point I'm just going to highlight some things. First of all, they're saying, the woman contrasted, saying a male manner of leadership is command and control, militaristic, top down, barking out orders, versus, to pick up what Amanda's saying, more indirect, like, you know, let me listen. How should we, or it's collaborative. How should we accomplish this? I think we should go in this direction. What do you say? Or what the other woman says, I want to be viewed as everybody's equal, but no one's superior. Again, all these women, by the way, are the way that their stance is coming from, since they're breaking through what they call the glass ceiling. So they have to operate in a different way. So the other woman said, I'm not looking to be light. I mean, I want to be offensive, but fundamentally, it's very critical that I be respected. I want people to value what I have to say and the expertise that I bring and the skill sets that I'm bringing forward to the table. Now, in a certain sense, all that's male, but in a certain sense, that since women, by the way, have to climb a further mountain to achieve that, they're oftentimes readily dismissed. Suzanne, have you seen that in the workplace, that women oftentimes, you'll have a situation where a woman gives an idea and that idea is dismissed, and then a guy, like A day later, it says the idea. It says, what a genius idea!
Yeah, it's very funny. I have a lot of female directors and leaders where I work, but there's sometimes I'll be in meetings where men will say things, and they say it, they're really saying garbage, but they say it so powerfully because they're men, I get the sense. And we can instant message and kind of say, like, they just say it with such force and power, and it's really garbage. And they love hearing themselves speak, and I feel like that's how they got where they are, because it's an interesting dynamic.
So you're bringing up the point of that many men, just like the opposite of this, where the woman has to be, in a certain sense, you know, 25% more smart and more innovative, because men have the upper edge, because they're already, if they act the part as a leader, they're most of the way there, even if insofar as substantively, they might not be adding so much. Is that what you're claiming?
Right. You have to ask.
See, has that been your experience? We have some women on the call. Michael, utilize your expertise.
I've had the experience where men will just talk over me.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, that's always a fun one. Where you may have something to contribute and they just, it's like you don't even exist.
Ouch. Okay. So that's why they had to, that's why the woman said she has to repeat herself. But she can't be chippy, or she can't be like, you know, chippy is a British word of being like, you know, how would I best, what's a good English, what's an American translation of that? Like, you know, come across in a very superficial or super feminine kind of way. I guess the American word would be more come across as shrill. That's a negative. In other words, just reassuring your point, speaking respectfully, insistent, consistent, persistent, and conveying, and all of them had to, navigate into a leadership position, which has been heretofore a man's world. So that's what they brought up. So just to recap, they felt that the woman manner classically is, you know, the man is the command and control, militaristic, top down, forceful, pushy, shovey. Obviously, it's a stereotype. Women more collaborative, more indirect. Since they're being used to, as Shana said, talked over, they have to be a little more insistent. They have to, you know, not to try to be a superior, you know, equal to all, not superior to none. These kind of ways have to find their own methodology to worm their way in to be a leader and manager of people, which is a hard job in general. All right, we're bringing this up because the Parsha touches upon the death of Miriam. We're going to get into that. Okay, let's go. Let's have somebody read. All right, Sean, you're reading the Parsha here.
The entire Israelite community came to the...
Oh, this is 1 second. Oh, well, 1 second. Oh, I apologize. I didn't recognize that. This is garbled. Hold on. That, I did not look at that. Well, technical difficulties, stand by. Okay, just here, stop share. All right. All right, do you guys see? Go ahead. Take it again from here. Sandra, can you read, or is it too small? Let me make it bigger.
That's good. I got it.
Go on.
Right. In the first month, the entire Israelite community came to the Tsin desert, and the people stopped in Kadesh. It was there that Miriam died and was buried. The people did not have any water, so they began demonstrating against Moshe and Aharon. The people disputed with Moshe. We wish that we had died together with our brothers before Hashem, they declared. Why did you bring Hashem's congregation to this desert, that we and our livestock should die? Why did you take us out of Mitzrayim and bring us to this terrible place? It's an area where there are no plants, figs, grapes, or pomegranates. Now, there's not even any water to drink. Moshe and Aaron moved away from the demonstration to the communion tent entrance and fell on their faces. Hashem's glory was revealed to them.
Okay, so just a couple seconds here, just to... Now, this chapter 20, okay, in Bamidbar, we have a fundamentally, not overt, but by we can figure out, the Torah has now skipped 38 and a half years, okay? We last left off with Korach, which seemed to have occurred right after the whole spy thing, which was in the second year. Now, Miriam dies, you know, this month, you're going to see in the same month, Miriam dies in the end of the Parsha. Aaron dies, her brother. It's all in the 40th year. So the Torah is completely silent for 38 years, which, of course, is an interesting question. Like, apparently, while we were waiting for all that generation to die, apparently nothing of eternal value occurred, which is very interesting, okay? So you should know that. So things start to spice up around here. So what happens? They show up to Kadesh, which is on the border, the southern border of the land of Israel. Miriam dies and is buried. People didn't have any water. They began demonstrating against Moshe and Aaron. Before we get to the water and the rock thing, we'll get to that. What's remarkable? What should be here? But you, what's interesting that you don't see any mention? And if you look later on, you will. It'll end the partial. You would ask the question, but I'm not showing you the end of the partial. What's your expect? Is there any expectations being violated here?
Shouldn't Moshe and Aaron be sitting Shiva for Miriam?
That's great. In other words, there's no mention of any mourning whatsoever by anyone. It just says she died there and buried. Next, the people didn't have any water. Now, anybody know what the people's response were for the death of Aaron at the end of the chapter, end of the Parsha? I'm going to go right now. One second. Here we go. I'm going to fast forward to the end of the Parsha. No, it's at the end. I'm sorry. I apologize. It's the end of this very chapter, chapter 20. I'm just going to fast forward. Hashem tells Moshe that Aaron's going to die. Moshe sends Aaron with the son Eliezer to the mountain of Hor. They climb up. They exchange garments. And let's reach the last sentence there. 29. All right, Sean.
The people realized that Aaron had died. The entire family of Yisrael mourned Aaron for 30 days.
Okay, so what's the obvious question?
Why didn't they mourn for Miriam?
Why not mourn? How long did they mourn for Moshe? Anybody know? Deuteronomy? Let's go here. Chad, this is the last chapter of the Torah, verse 34. Go ahead, read it out. 34:8. Go ahead.
The Israelites mourned Moshe in the west plains of Moab for 30 days. The wailing period of Moshe's mourning came to an end.
That's it. So you see, everybody else got 30 days, and Miriam is like radio silence over here. Now, keep that in mind. That's a long book. Come back. All right, now, what other questions we bring up here? Look at the verses 1, 2, 3.
What's the connection between Miriam's death and this lack of water?
All right, so the Torah is seeming to set it up as being there's some sort of causal relationship. And that's an excellent observation. Okay? So without going to how they resolve the water crisis, what do you got? But well, and what do you guys say? How would you explain that?
Like her presence, her holiness, like brought them water. So when she died, something in the environment changed.
So let me ask you a simple question. So are we reducing Miriam down to a rabbit's foot? When Miriam's there, she's a water lady. How do we explain that? She's like good karma. She brings the water. She dies, no water. You can argue. If the Jew people deserve to have water in the wilderness, they should have the water. And if they shouldn't, they shouldn't. Why is Miriam's death a factor?
Well, maybe her death like diminished the overall people's like level of holiness, or
okay. So let me. I like the way you're thinking. In what way? She's just like a. She's like. Again, is that a magical phenomena, or can we identify some real world causality to that?
Because water represents life, and Miriam represented life to the Jewish people. So the water stops because it's a symbol that when Miriam dies, the water represents life and the life that she brought to the Jewish people.
Now, it's true that throughout Tanakh, water is equated to life because it is a life source. Nobody can live without water. True. So, but there's no mention, you know, God's not saying, and now you're punished, you're not having water. You're just saying that she represents life. In other words, you're positing a correlation which is poetic, but not necessarily like A then B. You know what I'm saying? But clearly the Torah wants you to think about that, because it says she died and she's buried, people didn't have water. Now there's a crisis. So
maybe they didn't have water because it didn't mourn her. Maybe that was like a punishment.
So that's one angle. So what you're really saying, it's an onesh, it's a punishment. Here's a great woman, that's a good idea. Here's a great woman. Who could just identify some of Miriam's great moments? What was she known for in her life?
Well, she for the tambourine, when she was ready.
Okay, so number one, there's a famous that she led the Jewish people, the women of the Jewish people. After the splitting of the Red Sea, she brought out the musical instrument, and then they not only did they sing the song of Oz Yashir, you know, she led them in dance. Okay, so she led the entire Jewish women, or she was. That indicates that since she's leading the women in dance, and she's a prophetess, so she was heralded. And you looked upon as the number one role model for women. We never hear about Tzipora's involvement with the women, but we do hear about Miriam. What else? What's Miriam's famous openly in the Torah's famous thing that she did?
She saved Moshe.
Okay, there would not be the Chumash without Miriam. Okay, because basically
that's super funny, Rabbi Benny.
Right. So without Miriam, let's go back to the story here. Moshe's born during the decree, the short decree, a year-long decree of Paro, that all the boys have to be thrown into the Nile. Yocheved, Moshe's mother, keeps him hidden. And she's successful in keeping him for 3 months. Why can't she not keep him hidden for more than 3 months? Flame shot, guys. This is a little Chumash 101. Why is she having difficulty keeping Moshe, baby Moshe, hidden for more than 3 months?
They said to kill all the boys.
Okay, but she's keeping the kid hidden. What's a basic flame shot reason? Say it again, Amanda. It didn't come through.
He's getting bigger.
And therefore, what happens when kids get bigger? They are what?
They make noise.
Yes, they make noise, and they make louder noise. Now, if you hear a little baby, 1-week-old baby cry, that's one level of volume. Once they start to fill in, and 3 months and above, get bigger, they make a lot of noise. And basically, the authorities, Paul's authorities, are going through the Jewish neighborhood looking for little babies to kill. So basically, she had no choice. So as you know, she brought him down, put him in a basket, hid him in the reeds, sort of like that, and then and put, who'd she put on lookout duty?
Miriam.
Okay, the baby gets discovered by the daughter of Paro, and she comes zips down there, and how does she rescue Moshe? What's her offer? What's her deal? Anybody remember?
She tells her that she has a wet nurse for the baby.
Right. So she sees that the daughter of Paro has some compassion upon her, and she comes in quickly with, "Hey, not only that, I have a wet nurse who can just readily nurse the baby. You know, no fuss, no muss. All right." She comes in there, and the daughter of Paro says, "No problem. I'll pay for it." And therefore, she works it out that Moshe gets nursed and weaned by his own mother and gets paid for it. Okay, so basically, Miriam saves his life then. Okay. Who knows the Midrashic backstory even behind that?
Behind what?
Who knows the Midrashic conversation between Miriam and her father, Amram? This is an advanced question, but if you know your Midrashim, this is a famous one. They might know the Midrashic story, dialogue between Miriam, who's like a teenager, and Amram, her dad.
Yeah, is it the one that they tell the... no, it's not that one.
Anybody know? Anybody want to take a guess? All right. I'm going to tell you the story. Let me know if you've heard this before. That Amram, after the decree, Amram separated from his wife, Yocheved, saying, like, why should we have kids?
You're destroying the entire that's the one I thought it was. I saw myself right for you. She says that you're worse. You're creating a genocide.
Okay, so... But you get partial credit for that, Amanda, not full, because you didn't. You thought about it, but you didn't.
But I was scared. I was scared to say the wrong answer, so I stopped myself.
All right. So I'll fill everybody in.
Okay.
Amram basically leaves his wife, separates from his wife Yocheved, because why should we have another kid if it's going to get thrown into the Nile? And then. So Miriam and Aaron, the two kids who were born prior to the decree. So Miriam comes to mom, to dad, and says, "Hey, you're worse than Paro. Paro only decreed on the boys. You're decreeing on the boys and the girls. You know, because of your thing, you're killing everybody. You're causing these children not to come into being." All right, that medrash requires an explanation. But anyways. The Medrash says that she was able to broker the relationship, and Amram and Yocheved got back together. They remarried. There was apparently a divorce or separation. They remarried. So Midrashic Miriam is the woman or young lady who through force of logic is able to convince her family to get back together again. Okay? Now, we have one idea about the water. I'm going to now share, and I'm going to, now let's go back to the, we're going to check out some Rashi action. Okay, we're going to go back to the water and the rock if we got time. By the way, this is our third time to Parshas Chukas, and I think both Sean and Suzanne were there. So I'll just refresh. If you wanted, we had a class, one class on the laws of Chukim, which is the beginning of the Parsha. So you want to check about the Parduma of the Red Cow, we had a class on that. Check that out. We also had the Moshe's sin, because as you know, later on, he hits the rock, and then Moshe and Aaron get punished. And we did a whole class on that. So those two classes were already done. They're in the can, as they were. Why Yutera, you want to hear. This is our third class on Parsha Chukas. So you guys can, if you heard that shir, this is a new shir. Now, let's have a little Rashi action. Let me have Mendel read us some Rashi.
Rashi and Miriam died there. Why is this section narrating the death of Miriam placed immediately after the section treating of the red cow? To suggest to you the following comparison. What is the purpose of the sacrifices? They affect atonement. So too does the death. Does the death of the righteous affect atonement?
Okay. So ironically, this is going the opposite direction of Sean. Sean was saying that the water, the holding back of the water, was really a punishment for the people's poor response. Ungrateful response to the death of Miriam. Basically, she died and nobody did anything.
Well, not only didn't they mourn her, but then they started complaining about like the land, almost like the spies did.
Right, they're going back, and they seem to be going back to the same traits as their parents, who said the exact same words and got punished by not going to the land. Mm-hmm. So Rashi says an amazing statement that the death of the righteous affect atonement. Now, on the surface, what is troubling about that midrashic statement that Rashi is quoting us?
It didn't atone.
The what? Obvious.
Good. Mandel?
Sean was going to say something, I think, no?
All right, Sean, you're on.
I was just going to say, so they didn't atone. They're totally 180 on that idea.
Right, so you're saying, first of all, where's the atonement? I see them getting worse. Boom. What else?
I mean, I think the obvious question on Rashi is that if the death of the righteous is supposed to affect atonement, that would be evident if they were actually mourning Miriam, but they're not. Or it doesn't say that they did.
Right. So if you're going like Sean, basically, I don't see any growth here. I don't see any atonement. Now, doesn't sound, when you read this statement, doesn't sound like Jesus? You know, like Jesus died for our sins. So we have the death of the righteous effect atonement. Does that sound a little similar?
I was reading it as it causes tshuva to occur in the people. Ideally, when the righteous person dies, in this case Miriam, that's the way I was reading it, right?
Okay, we're gonna circle back, but it's
right. Same as me. That's how I read it.
Right. So okay. So fine. But you're saying not only do I not see any tshuva going on, I see a complete death spiral of imperfection happening.
Right. Like Miriam.
Worse.
Right. So I'm thinking of Miriam as a person who was educating the people, whoever, you know, in whatever capacity she could, and her death represented a gap in education, and so the people regressed and started complaining about the water.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna circle back to Rashi, because Rashi, let me share you an idea right now. Rashi is the ultimate curator of Midrashim. I'm just giving you a general principle. What is Rashi doing in general? He's walking into, he's walking into the reservoir of Midrashim, which there are thousands, okay? And he goes and samples and cuts out that Medrash, which he thinks is the most critical to deciphering the entire unit, okay? So instead of you going through all the Midrashim, he's going to pick out a little nugget. It's called a Midrashic nugget, and he's going to display it. Now, the challenge is every Midrash requires a deciphering. A Midrash is never going to show you its treasure on the surface. A Midrash is locked in a treasury box. What all of us have to do, we're going to do this tonight, is to dip into our pockets and consider different ideas, and those are the keys, to open, unlock the door and to sort of expose the real treasure, which is the Midrash. Because on the surface, it seems paradoxical. It seems very difficult to get in. You know what I'm saying? I'm giving you a methodological principle here. Midrashim sort of keep their secrets close to their chest, to their vest. And our challenge here is, by working out on the pshat, is to work out a fundamental principle and then get in there to uncover that secret. You understand what I'm saying? It's a puzzle. It was designed as a puzzle. Mm-hmm. Before I go on, is that principle, that broad principle of Midrashim, is that clear to everybody?
I think so. But in terms of this Rashi, just to be clear on that, is Rashi saying that Miriam essentially died like for the sins of the people? Is that what?
I was just bringing that as a question, on the surface. What does that mean? Now she's dying and they're somehow getting atonement?
It is a little Jesus-y.
Right. I thought people were going to, I thought I wouldn't have to super suggest it, but you guys were going on the point like, no. There's no atonement going on here. These people are getting worse. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that the two distinguishments were one reading like she died for the sins of the people versus her death causes people to then want to atone for themselves.
Okay.
Kind of like.
Fine. Now, again, yeah. I'm just raising possible questions you can do when you look at that Rashi. Oh, all right. But we're clear on the paradoxical nature of this Medrash. Okay.
You've trained us to be more sophisticated thinkers than that. Thank you.
Yeah, I understand that. Well, that's correct. I'm going to read and translate the Ralbah. There is no English translation. I had no time to write, translate this passage. So I'm going to read and translate it to you now. Okay. So, below I am my Ada. There was no water for the congregation. Hine samach zela seif sipur mitat miryam. This no lack of water, this episode, is put right next to the recounting of the death of Miriam. All right. Lahair, to reveal to us, Shemitat HaTzadikim Oset Roshem, that the death of the righteous makes an impression. Okay, that's a very important point. Okay, that the death of the righteous makes a impression. Now, the Ralbag is going to present three possibilities how Miriam's death would have made an impact. Okay? All right? Everybody clear on that? We have his postulate. Now we're going to go further. Number one, Bechshav ki em Miriam haita moshech lady strab mechachmata lavort Hashem mitala. I think, this is the Ralbach speaking, this is his own theory, that Miriam drew the minds of the Jewish people with her wisdom to serve God, may be exalted. Ki'ilu Amar, that is this to say that if Miriam was around, the Jewish people would have never destroyed the circumstance to ask for water in such an aggressive, complaining manner. Stop right there. Okay. According to the Ralbag, In what way does the righteous make the death of a righteous make an impression? It's very interesting. What do you say? So he says that if Miriam was around, nor that she was still alive, she would have drawn the minds of the Jewish people with her wisdom to serve. She in general drew the Jewish people's minds to serve God, as if to say that if she was still around, the Jewish people would not have stumbled or destroyed the circumstance by asking water from Moshe in this aggressive manner. What is he essentially saying?
Just by her presence, like the people were like on elevated.
How? Just magically? He's demagicifying the process.
Well, the people were on like their like best behavior, so like they were.
Does he say that like they were like? Is it like Miriam was like the like the mashkiach, like she was the watch person, and therefore they don't want to, she's like the spiritual lifeguard, and they don't want to mess around when she's around. Is that what he's saying? It's deeper.
What he's saying is that the people were so inspired by her that they wouldn't have acted that way in front of her. You act different in front of an esteemed rabbi or teacher than you do around your friends.
100% correct. Inspired in what sense? They just like they see her and they go, ooh. What's the source?
They were inspired. They were inspired by her actions.
Not only by her actions, but by her teachings.
By her words.
By her teachings. In other words, going back, would the women of Israel would have followed any woman in dance after the miracle of the splitting of the Red Sea? Why'd they do that? Because they felt that Miriam is a prophetess. And this response of musical instruments, dance, and song is an appropriate expression of thanking Hashem. Or they took her lead. She's an educational leader. Let me give you words that they use in modern America. She's a thought leader. People are looking to her. What's her attitude? What's her opinion? What's her idea? What's her concept? What is the Ralbag saying? Why did this episode occur? Because if she was around, her impact could have very well, the fact that they're saying it's a causally connected, it may not have occurred in such a tumultuous, disaster-like fashion. You know what I'm saying? She would have been her presence and her insight and her influence. Now let's contrast it by the video we saw about the women leaders of England that were being expressed there. How does that compare and contrast? What do you guys say? Let me hear somebody. People I've known who's on the calls there. Who else? Who's been quiet? Who's the who's 914? Who's the 914 number? All right.
Alan, why are the
mouse cats
on the
table?
Oh,
maybe
look at the back.
Suzanne. What do you say, Suzanne? How do you compare Miriam's influence to what the
women, I'm like, I'm behind the table.
Women executives?
Her influence to, well, these people are so in the present, but she left such an impression. I mean, I don't know that they leave the impression that someone like Miriam leaves, obviously.
Right. In other words, she doesn't have to use, these methodologies for control. In other words, she doesn't have to use command and control. She doesn't have to use collaborative methods of control. She doesn't have to use different ways of engaging. People follow her because her depth of knowledge is such that it's automatic that she's, in other words, she walks in the room, you know she's the smartest person in the room. You ever have a situation where the people, like, if that person's there, they're automatically the leader? You know, it's not like a debate. Well, who should be the leader? Okay? This person, she's a prophetess. She's older than Moshe and Aaron. You know what I'm saying? She has intrinsic gravity. You know what I'm saying? All right, let's go on to the second theory. We're running out of time. Oh yeah, Ratzon Bezel Ayir She'ilu Hayah Miriam B'Chayav Hayim Nimlachim Bam Moshe Ba'aron K'mash Tziva Hashem Yisrael Otam B'Dibartim Al Selah Baita Hi Tziva L'Sham Ram Yikashel B'Zot HaMitzvah Ki Hi Hayta Neviya Gam Hi Hayta Gidol Hashanim Mehem Yirim Hashem Cholkim Kabod L'Lakach Zayt Menemena. All right, I'll just summarize. The second theory of how Miriam would make an impression and therefore the water situation would have not unraveled. As you all know, Moshe is overwhelmed by the problem. They speak to God. God says, go to the rock, hit the rock. They hit the rock. Somehow or another, there's some error made. The people get the water, but Moshe and Aaron get a decree that they're not going to go into the land of Israel. They're severely punished. Says the Rabbah, if Miriam would have been around, she would have had influence on Moshe and Aaron. Because she's a prophetess. She's older than them. They would have taken counsel from her. And therefore, she could have provided some guidance to avoid the catastrophe. So what the Ralbog's viewing is that her leaving, in other words, he's going like this. Their lacking water was a natural phenomena. But why was there a catastrophe linked to Miriam's death? Because Miriam's not there to save them. There's two possibilities. Number one, she could have been influenced the people. B, she could have influenced Moshe and Aaron to navigate the situation better. And since she's a Neviah, so she has viewed as being a person who is of powerful insight, as the Rambam says, the mark of the Navi, or the Neviah, or the male or female Neviah, is Kovesh et Yitro Bedaito, has complete control of their desires, emotions, and compulsions based upon their wisdom, nearly always. Always in control, okay? Now, if we're having a good day, we're often in control, okay? But then 3 o'clock, you get a little hungry, and you walk into the kitchen pantry area, and somebody decides to leave out 6 intimate donuts. And then we're not so much in control, okay? Defeated by an intimate donut. The mark of a prophetess or a prophet is that they're only going to do what wisdom dictates, which, if you can think about that, is a huge level, okay? So therefore, her insight is going to be insightful. B, she's fundamentally pretty much objective all the darn time. And 3, she's their older sister, and they're going to value her insight. The Rabbah speculates that if she was around, the Moshe's failure in leadership, Moshe and Aaron's failing leadership would not have occurred, which is a very interesting thought. Okay? They would have listened to her. In the same way, going back when she was a teenager, Midrashic Miriam tells her father, you should get remarried to mom and have kids because you're going to be worse than Pharaoh. and the argument Amram found very compelling. So already the Midrashim are already creating a picture of Miriam as being a powerful person who, when great people stumble, she sees through that and she comes and saves the day. Then we have the third theory, which is very interesting. Okay. The third thing is that when she dies, within 1 month, all three of the dream team dies. She dies. In our own chapter, her younger brother, Aaron, dies. And within 6 weeks, or a couple weeks, Moshe dies. Why is it so critical? What's the idea that they all three die? Why are they all dying in 1 week, all 1 month? What is that to suggest? Why can Moshe and Aaron live on longer? What does that teach you?
Good things come in threes.
Okay. What else you got?
They were dependent on each other.
What?
They were dependent on each other.
Exactly. They were exactly. In other words, the most classic example is you have a husband and wife who celebrate their 65th anniversary. Then one of them dies. It's very common for their spouse to die within the year. It's a very common phenomenon. Because their whole life was wrapped up, their whole life and their way of navigating life, and they had basically merged into like one, you know, inextricable team. And one dies, they can't function properly. That's by, you know, in an emotional, romantic relationship. But similarly, the three siblings, Miriam, Aaron, Moshe, the three prophets, the three greatest siblings of all time, imagine one family, three prophets, amazing. They were the dream team. And once Miriam thing, this is sort of indicating that basically their whole, that there's a, they sort of, each one's apparently strengths and weaknesses played off each other. And their leadership was done by, even though we hear Moshe's doing a lot of the thing, but there's a lot of behind the scenes action. See, Miriam is the quintessential behind the scenes person, but apparently you could tell her influence when she goes out there and starts, and she can lead the entire women. So she already has, she wields profound influence. So really, one mark of woman power in Judaism is really a woman's power, a woman leader, classically in the Tanakh, is oftentimes powerful and silent, or in behind the scenes, in a certain sense, but simultaneously, the three. Moshe and Aaron, who you think are like the star of the show, the Rabbag, and brings a proof from a verse in Zechariah, really, there was an interconnectedness, a dependence on each other. They couldn't function one without the other as far as leading the Jewish people. It was a group effort. So basically, what's going on here, and then he goes into the Midrash and says that the water was only there because of the merit of Miriam. Now, what he essentially said, the merit of Miriam, which means that her, which he's in a certain sense suggesting, her influence, whether it be on the people or whether it be on Moshe and Aaron, basically kept the Jewish people on a much higher level and a much more effective level. And therefore, they were successful. Now let's go back to the Rashi, okay? What's the deal with the Rashi? Rashi says the death of the prophet, there was, Why is it put right after the law of the red cow? To teach you that just the red cow provides atonement, so too the death of the Miriam provides an atonement. What idea is that now? How does that work? So I think, so the key first step is, does the atonement happen automatically?
No.
They die, suddenly, ding, the atonement lights up. How does atonement work? What does atonement even mean? Who can explain this? Anybody have any thoughts?
For Miriam's passing away, I mean, I guess ostensibly, like, the people would ideally feel a significant loss of the righteous person, right? This person has affected their lives to such a degree that after their passing, they feel an emptiness. And so they will be moved to tshuva once they feel the loss of the wisdom that this person imparted in their lives, or help them go to in their lives.
Do you think that happens immediately?
It depends on I think this story is about, first of all, the lacking on the part of the people, and also the degree to which Miriam was a tzenua and a tzedekus, etc. There's two sides to it, but no, I don't think it, depending on the wisdom of the people, it could be immediately or it could be after time.
Okay, so there's a three-word verse in the Tanakh you need to know. And we could reduce down to three words. Zecher, Tzadik, Livracha. Have you all heard that phrase?
Say that after somebody dies, after their name.
Right, they say Zecher, Tzadik, Livracha. The memory of the righteous is for a blessing. Obvious question. Why is it the memory of the righteous is for a blessing? Why not the righteous are blessed? Why is it the memory of the righteous are blessed?
Because that's all you
because
have.
Because the memory makes you act righteous.
Why not? Why aren't they viewed as blessed when they're alive? This is the key move here, guys. Let's see if you can figure it out.
A lot of the time, people don't realize the good that they have.
Why not?
That's the nature of people.
But what counterforce is in play?
Basically, like human emotion. So, like, what made Miriam so special? Like, she was a Navi, so she kind of a Navi. So she like, it's like you don't let your instincts and your emotions get the best of you. So when it's just a memory of someone, it's just the good things that they've been.
But why do people recognize when people are alive? The truth is, even for a person who's not fully righteous like Miriam, how about a regular person? Why do people not appreciate their parents or their loved ones until they're dead?
Because it's easy to get, like, let life get caught up with them.
What's the counterforce? There's got to be, what's causing us to not appreciate it? Not just we're caught up in life. Let's get a little more, add a little more meat to that bone. Okay, Shayna, what do you say?
Well, for when they're not here, we miss them, and there are times that we need them. Now we take advantage that, you know, our parents are just like a phone call away. And when they're no longer that's when it's their memory.
So when the person's around, we naturally assume, as Shay says, they're already here. There's a phone call away.
They're going to be around.
They're going to be around. And B, our natural sense of entitlement is, of course, we should have fantastic people like this available on demand to help us out in all these different kind of ways. The nature of the world should provide this. That's one factor. Another factor is there's a part of us, certainly of the righteous people, that we're jealous of them. We don't want to recognize their greatness, because if we recognize their greatness, what does that oftentimes make us feel about ourselves?
we're inadequate or we're low or we're not right. So enough.
If I have to accept that this person, this Miriam or this Moshe, this Aaron or whoever the great person is great, that by definition reflects of my lowness. I don't want to dwell on my lowness. But then the person passes on. The competition is over. The jealousy is over. The reality that they're not going to be to help us is painfully present. Then all their goodness comes to the fore. Let me give you a story that I personally experienced. I'm going to take you back to 1986. Here's a scene. I'm standing in the middle of Broadway in the Lower East Side. I'm with at least 100, if not 200,000 people. We're out next to the yeshiva in the Lower East Side called Mesifta Tiferet Yishalayim, and they're broadcasting the eulogies of the funeral of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of that yeshiva, and basically was, through his writing of the responsum called the Igrat Moshe, was like the seminal halachic authority in 20th century America. Okay? Now, I want to go back. So, and then when they brought his casket to Israel, how many people showed up for his funeral in Israel? I don't remember the exact figure. It was in the 300,000 to 500,000 people. Okay? The 500,000 people came to line the streets and pay homage to Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay? Because he was famous. Now, I want to ask you a question. So based upon that, extrapolating out, so I was there with 200,000 in America, another 300,000 to 500,000 in Israel. Okay, let's say all in, max, is 700,000 Jews. Okay? How many people do you think attended his daily shiur, which was available to anybody who wanted to come? Throw out a number.
25.
10?
About 15. Now, you could argue that, hey, that's a very high-level shiur. You have to be highly educated to participate in that, which is true. But still, 15 versus 800,000, there's a little bit of a disconnect over here, okay? So he was, even though he was a great man, he was extremely accessible. If you had a question, you could pick up the phone and call, hello, Rabbi Feinstein, I have a halachic question. Can I ask you, any one of you on this call, let's say, in 1980, he could have made that phone call, and he would have given you an answer. Okay? But the wild thing is that people knew him as the main guy. He was, just to give you a sense, because, you know, at every class at MJE, we have to mention Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who, by the way, was a first cousin. He had halachic problems. He says, you should call Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Okay? Okay, that's a big deal. So, but when he's alive, people like, you know, he's always going to be around. If I have a hard halachic question, I got his number and I'll call him. There was a woman, just to give you a sense, that would call him every week to ask what time candlelighting is. Okay? And he took the call and he said, yes, Mrs. Goldberg, it's 8:17 this week. Have a good Shabbos. And ours, he had patience. He didn't say, like, hey, I'm the Gadolador of I'm the number one halachic decisor of this generation. Mrs. Goldberg wants to know what time to light the Shabbos candle. He's telling her he's not chill about it. You know what I mean? And people they view him as being like, he's going to, of course, be there. You know, now, I'm just saying, he was appreciated, but not really appreciated until he died. And then suddenly, 800,000 people in two continents show up for his funeral. You know what I'm saying? So that's just an extreme example. There's so many other examples. Miriam was like that. Going back to what Sean said, it's a good theory. There are people that say that. Why do they not get water? Because really, that was wrong. She died. She saved Moshe. She was a critical member, it was called, of the inner cabinet. Women look for her as being a thing. And she died, and people didn't give a damn. You know what I'm saying? That can so happen. The same thing, if you also read out, when you read this stuff, same thing with Yoshua, the last chapter of Yoshua. He dies. There's no mention of a greater mourning. And the rabbis tell us that people were like, oh, you know, we got bills to pay and meetings to catch, and they did not even interrupt their schedule, which was a big sin. So that theory that Sean's giving has a good support in the portion. But my main point here, going back to women power, is that her power was not as fundamentally women. It wasn't so much feminine, female, other than the fact that she could see mistakes that other people, i.e. men, would make, and she would see through that and be able to provide counsel and direction. So when men falter, she would be able to make an intervention and be effective. But her essential leadership was just being, you know, Miriam, being a source of wisdom, a source of inspiration, and a source of, And the truth is that, we all have people in our lives that provide great, all of us provide great support, the insight, inspiration, and oftentimes, none of us, myself included, are really good at really showing, gratitude. And it's something that you don't want to wait till the last second, you know, and, it's an important point. And oftentimes, and this story shares that when Miriam left, the situation sort of unraveled. They sort of like went back to the same level they were, like in the previous chapter, when they're like completely, hysterical and, want to go back to Egypt. It's funny how there's a few people can keep the whole place together. Another important thing, you see that the influence of one person can make a profound difference to keep everything together. So, there's a couple of ideas about Miriam that I wanted to share with you tonight. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. But with Miriam's presence, like, they still had all those other issues, like the spies happened, they complained about meat. So how do we, connect that, where people still made a lot of complaints even when she was around?
Right. So the way the Rabbag is suggesting, let's analyze his methodological point. He says she dies and she's been buried, and then there's no water. There's a connection. He's basically arguing that what caused that situation to unravel? Her absence. So he's saying that if in this situation, obviously she's not it's not magic. She's not the solution to every problem. Okay, but apparently you see something very intriguing, that really there are many problems that could have happened. In other words, we say a very interesting statement in the Amidah, which is very a little bit mysterious. In the modem, we thank God, right, for our life and our souls, right? But all nisecha shebechol yomano, but on all the miracles that happen every day, erev boker v'tzehorayim, evening, afternoon, and morning. Where are the miracles? We don't see any open miracles. Fundamentally, what that's suggesting is that the existence of the Jewish people is fundamentally, intrinsically against the laws of nature. Basically, we all should not be here. And if it wasn't for hidden miracles, and that could be done through the leadership of certain great people doing all kinds of certain things that we don't see. In other words, and this is an idea from Rabbi Soloveitchik, is that there are many heroes and heroines throughout Jewish history that preserve the people that we don't even know. And his proof for that is that the Talmud only records a handful of the names of the men of the Great Assembly, which had 120 members. Of the 120 members, we know maybe 10, 15 names. Now, obviously, if they had other people, the other 105 weren't losers, right? So they really helped the Jewish people through a major transition in the Second Temple era. But that's not just them, it's always. There are many people who are not looking for the spotlight, who are not getting the fanfare, who sort of keep the good ship lollipop, the Jewish people, alive. And what he's saying, interesting enough, is that there could have been many other issues that occurred over the 40 years that could have, the situation could have ended up much worse. Doesn't mean that she's going to solve all the problems, all that. She's not Superman or Superwoman, you know what I'm saying? But he's suggesting the fact that the Parsha puts it together. And by saying that the Midrash says that they got water by virtue of the merit of Miriam. The merit of Miriam really means the powerful leadership and insight and inspiration of Miriam basically kept everything going. And when she's gone, there was an immediate drop. Things start to fall apart. And you see that, by the way, like in businesses. Who's ever seen this? Like, you often you'll have a business, let's say a small business, maybe 15, 20, 30 employees, right? And there's a person that does a lot, right? And nobody gives that person much credit, right? And then the person leaves, and suddenly this falls apart, and that falls. Who's supposed to order the toner? And who's supposed to do this? And who's, oh, that was that. Oh, and then after the person's gone, you start to appreciate the profound impact on the organization of the person, but they didn't appreciate it at the time, but they were doing lots of things behind the scenes that kept the whole thing going. Now, oftentimes that person left because they were sick and tired of not getting appreciation for keeping the place together. You know what I mean? That often happens. But then people recognize, we were stupid to not really appreciate the person and promote the person and give proper thanks. You know what I'm saying? This happens all the time, every day in America, American businesses. You know what I'm saying? So that's on a micro level. The Jewish people on a macro level, there are a lot of anonymous people that keep the whole place going. I mean, right now, there are people in a bunker in Tel Aviv that are involved in surveillance, cyber security, and they're involved in things of ensuring that the threat of Iran and things in Syria are maintained. We don't know their name. They're basically keeping 7 million Jews alive in Israel. We know right now that teams of special forces are deployed in Israel, from Israel to various places behind enemy lines that keep the Jewish people safe. We don't know who they are. Those names won't be declassified for 50, 60 years. And you don't know which one or the combination of them are basically keeping the Jewish people alive. So there's another corollary. There's the idea of the woman power, and there's the power of the unknown hero. And the Jewish people depend upon that. Another idea. All right, we've gone over time here. So I want to wish everybody a wonderful evening, and I'll see people tomorrow night at MGE and those at the spring retreat. Have a good night, guys.
Thanks, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Good night.